In the studio with me this morning, I have Mel Rands from EcoStore fame here in Auckland. Mel has been in the environmental organic scene for the past 23 years. He also, with his wife Melanie, are co-founders of Mamaki, New Zealand's first permaculture eco-village. Also, he was invited to join New Zealand's Business Council for Sustainable Development. This is a premier organisation in New Zealand with limited membership, including Toyota, Shell Oil, BP. And Mel has been instrumental in bringing many organic cleaning products, hair products, etc. for babies into the supermarket chains here in New Zealand, so that you can go to any supermarket now and get the organic requirements, particularly for your children. So, Mel, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming.
Hi, Tom.
Mel, well, as you know, you have many years' experience in the organic game. You know a lot of the ecological challenges, particularly when it comes to buying products for homes, where we have to clean, where we have to wear clothing, particularly, of course, babies. We'll start with babies because that's where the human species start. So how do you see your role in bringing ecological awareness through the retail section, through shops, to the New Zealand public?
Well, many years ago, when we started our permaculture village up in Northland, Metapori Bay, which is on the Turitaka coast, we got together. We had 150 acres that we were land we had control of, and we were very lucky that all the water coming onto our property was coming from this pristine scenic reserve called the Soda Spring Reserve. And we thought, as a challenge, wouldn't it be great if the water leaving our property was just as pure as the water coming onto our property? And we thought, we're a bit cocky in some ways, we thought, well, we're all organic experts here, we'll be able to crack this, no trouble at all. But then we started looking at the houses that we lived in, the everyday household products that you and I use, and we were outraged about what was in these products. We hadn't really done the study of what was happening, and we were even doing things like using our laundry water straight from the washing machine onto our organic gardens. And once we analysed what was in these products, we were flabbergasted. So right back in about 1986, we started looking at what chemicals were in everyday products that you use and what effect it would have on the planet, because we wanted our waters not to be polluting the streams and then going down polluting the estuaries and affecting the fish life. And that was one of the ways that we thought, well, people are overwhelmed with the global imbalance in the environment. They think, well, what can I do? And so with EcoStore, we thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if in your everyday actions you could make a difference? And so instead of looking at sort of very flash things, we thought, let's start with the things you do every day, like washing your clothes, washing your hair. We also had a full range of organic gardening products, so you know you can actually grow your own food, looking after your animals. So we specialized in cleaning products, in body care products, organic gardening products, and animal products. And the amazing thing is that we started 12 years ago as a mail order catalogue only, because that way we could still live in Metapori Bay and look after people right throughout New Zealand. And the incredible thing for us, which shocked even us because we weren't expecting this, is within almost weeks of us starting to provide households around New Zealand with cleaning products, we started getting these letters back saying, since using your laundry liquid, my eczema's disappeared. I haven't got any rashes anymore. When I do the cleaning, I used to sneeze all the time. I'm not doing that anymore. Right through to my asthma has gone away. And we thought, what on earth is happening? This was why we didn't expect this at all, because we were looking from a pollution point of view. But strangely enough, if it hurts the planet, hey, it's going to hurt humans as well. And the two things often tie together. So there's actually a very personal as well as a whole planet-wide look at what you do in your daily lives. And what is actually happening is that for now, a long time, for about the last 50 years, there's been more and more cheap industrial petrochemicals being used in everyday products. A lot of them were actually developed during World War II, and once the war was over, they thought, well, what are we going to do with these chemicals? And they started using them for cleaning and for farming. And people don't... laundry is a really good example. People don't realize that after you've done your laundry and you've gone through those two rinse cycles, there's still a lot of residue of these chemicals left in your clothes. And they end up against your skin, and they're up against your skin like 24/7. I mean, the only time you haven't got these chemicals up against your skin is if, you know, like they're in your underwear, they're in your bed clothes, they're in the towel. So the only time you're having it happening is if you're naked, basically. And we don't spend that much time naked, do we? And so what happens is these chemicals will travel through your skin. And actually, believe it or not, chemicals travelling through your skin are actually more dangerous than eating them, because as hunter-gatherers over the last millions of years, we've actually developed very good defence systems for things we put in our mouth. We've got, starting in the mouth, the saliva going down to all the acids and the bacteria in our guts, so we can actually take out a lot of nasties. But if it goes through your skin, the body has got no defence at all. And what ends up happening is it's attacking your immune system, and it's attacking your hormonal system. And if you look at the diseases of the modern age, they're nearly all hormonal and systems of your immune system being upset. Like when I was young, if you went to my class, I think we had one boy who had a puffer that he'd used for his asthma, and maybe he'd use it after sport, and that was it. If you go to primary schools today, up to a third of the children in that class are going to have asthma. Same with eczema. Huge numbers of kids at the moment have got eczema. And we get parents coming to us all the time, and they're just so distraught because the kids are itching all the time. They've got cracked skin. Immune system is being attacked, and this is some of the what is happening. And I'll give you an example of one of the chemicals, because this is all sort of, you know, well, what are you talking about? Okay, here's a very good example. About 30 years ago, scientists discovered this wonderful little chemical called an optical brightener. And what this chemical does is they put it in all washing powders, because, and it has to be a residue in your clothes or else it won't work. So this chemical is left in your clothes, and when UV light, which as you know is invisible, hits this chemical, it's got the ability to slightly change the wavelength of this chemical. So the invisible light will change slightly towards white light and will come off as visible light. So you've got UV invisible light hitting your clothes, being slightly changed wavelength and coming off as visible light. Suddenly a lot more light is coming off your clothes and they look whiter and brighter. I don't know if you've ever heard this. They're no cleaner. They're no cleaner, but there's a lot more light coming off them. So they're looking whiter and brighter. Brand new clothes, they put lots of optical whiteness in, because if you go into a shop and you see a stack of t-shirts and one sort of glowing, you have whiteness and the other one's dull, it's just human nature. You go for the bright ones. Okay, that'd be fine if somehow they could keep these chemicals on the outside of your clothes, but of course they're right through your clothes, they're up against your skin, and no one is denying that optical brighteners upset your immune system. So we've got this amazing trade-off. To get our clothes looking slightly whiter and brighter, we're subjecting our immune system to this incredible punishment. EcoStore products, of course, will not use optical whiteness. And in fact, there's a whole range of what we call the nasty chemicals that we refuse to use in any of our products in the whole range.
Do you want to mention a couple of the nasty chemicals, or is it not even worth...
Well, I mean, I've mentioned optical whiteners. Yeah. I mean, a lot of them are very technical, long names. The interesting thing for us was that we thought as long as we stick to the natural plant-based world, we'd be all right. But unfortunately, it's actually more complicated than that, because some of the chemicals based on plants as opposed to oil are actually can have bad effects on the health as well. So when we look at an ingredient for an EcoStore product, first we look, is it sustainable? So then, of course, all your petrochemicals are out the door because we're going to run out of those. And secondly, we look, what is the effect on humans' health? And so another one that people might have heard of is something called sodium lauryl sulfate. A lot of people are thinking, oh, I don't want that anymore. It's a foaming agent. It's in nearly all your dishwashers. It's in your shampoos. It's in your toothpaste. And it's an eco ingredient. It's okay because it comes from coconut and it biodegrades really quickly. So in some ways you'd say, okay, that'll be all right. But unfortunately, it is a very, very strong skin irritant. It's used for cleaning factory floors. It's used as shark repellent. Scientists actually use it on skin testing because they know if they put that on the skin, they'll get a really bad irritation. Then they test other chemicals using sodium lauryl sulfate as the worst scenario. And as I said, if you look at the instructions on your toothpaste, on your shampoo, on your dishwashing liquid, they won't show it. All based on sodium lauryl sulfate. So we've actually got quite a battle here, is that we're looking, one, what's the effect on the planet? Secondly, what's the effect on human health?
Well, are you getting support from anyone within the medical fraternity to, other than, say, naturopaths and the holistic paradigm? Are you, is the health department in on anything?
A lot of what we're talking about, like many of these things, like the chlorine in the water, the fluoride, the mercury in your teeth, you can get scientists coming on both sides, you know. So a lot of the stuff isn't black and white. But what we have is we have the policy that if there's any doubt about these ingredients, we won't use them. And because there are always alternatives. And so that is, so that said and done, we do have a lot of doctors. We do have a lot of, as you said, alternate health workers, a lot of midwives, all telling people to use our products. But it's not like official government practice. Because, as I said, I mean, they'd also be telling people, don't put mercury in your teeth, don't get the chlorine out of your water, don't use fluoride, you know, because I believe in all those things as well. But the government's not saying that.
It's like if you live for 70, if you get to 70 years of age, well, that's long enough innings. When in actual fact, if we eat good food, organic food, if we exercise and breathe, we could live far longer than that. But it's, the status quo is if you do it at 70, 75, 80 years, well, that's old enough. But from what I gather, if we really take care of our body and are conscious of what we put into it, we'll live far longer.
Yes, well, I mean, there's a lot of doom and gloom about pollution, and but if you get a few base things right, you actually are, you can be just as safe today as you ever were, because the body is an amazing, amazing machine. It actually can take a lot of nasties and pollution and get rid of them. Because, as I said, we used to be hunter-gatherers, we used to, nature's full of poisons, because it's trying to stop, plants is trying to stop herbivores eating them. Yeah, there's all sorts of things out there. I mean, there's a lot of natural things, you know, like deadly nightshades and poisons, which are natural. So the body has to be able to get rid of us. But what's happening is that we're overwhelming ourselves. So if we can get down to a certain state, we can be just as healthy as ever. And the three things that I talk about that you do, one, the food, fresh, raw, as much raw as possible, so it's got a lot of life force, and organic if possible, because if it's organic, you still will have the full range of minerals and trace elements, which unfortunately have come out of the chemical agriculture, because they're just using three chemicals in most agriculture.
NPK.
Nitrogen, yeah, NPK, mm-hmm. And which does the sort of the heavy work of shooting a plant up, but it doesn't have all the other trace elements which looks after the health of the plant. And that's why we're having to rely so much on pesticides and fungicides, and because the plants aren't healthy. and they get attacked by nature because nature doesn't like healthy plants, so it'll attack it. And then we need all the pesticides and fungicides to actually stop nature from doing its job. They've done surveys, for example, one I love, the noble silver beet. It's a plant, like every house in New Zealand could grow a silver beet plant. It's almost impossible to kill one. They did, in Australia, up in Queensland, they took a range of vegetables straight out of the supermarket, and then they analysed them, and they got some vegetables from an organic garden, and they analysed those. With things like calcium, they found 200 times more in the organic. With iron, they found 50 times more. And so we're talking about the bones, we're talking about the blood, which a lot of people are worried about. They had 200 times and 50 times more in the organic than in the chemically grown supermarket product. And that's because it comes from a living soil with all the tiny little micro elements. And
earthworms too.
Well, the earthworms, people know about it, but people don't realise that science actually knows more about space than it knows about soil. They've discovered lately that in like a little drop of soil, there's actually like a million unique different types of bacteria, different species in one little grain of soil. They just do not know how soil, and these all interact. And nature doesn't need a garden to come along with fungicides and fertilizer. And nature looks after itself, and it does it very well. And it's all through the soil and the complex microorganisms in the soil react with each other and actually provide the food and the healthy variety for the plants. So, going back to what I'm talking about, the three things, the food. Fresh food, raw food as much as possible, organic if possible. Secondly, water. Filter your water. You do not want to be drinking chlorine. I mean, I can understand why there's chlorine in the water, because the civil authorities want to make sure no bugs get into the system. And the easiest way to do that is to kill it with something very strong like chlorine. But you don't want to be drinking this chlorine, because what happens is your own system is full of a microflora of bacteria and good fungi that help you digest. And every time you put chlorine on them, you're killing them. And so you're stopping yourself digesting properly. It can be solved a very simple, like $200, and that'll last forever. Filter, and then it only costs about $40 every 2 years to replace the cartridge. Not very big investment, really, is it?
I agree.
Tiny investment. And then suddenly you're getting chlorine and a lot of other chemical impurities out of your water. So therefore you've got your food, you've got your water. And then the third one, I wouldn't have even been saying myself until we investigated this 20 years ago, is everyday household chemicals. Get them out of your life. You don't need them. Other ones, the eco-friendly, healthy ones work just as well. They're just as inexpensive. And suddenly, up against your body, you haven't got these chemicals affecting your hormonal system and your immune system all the time.
Good. So are you talking about cleansers like...
I'm talking about, as I said, the most important one is your laundry, because it ends up against your skin.
Okay.
But then you've got your dishwashing liquid, if you're doing hand dishing, you've got your hands in this water. Warm water opens up your pores and the skin, and the chemicals can just rush straight in, right? Okay, so then dishes, okay. Then the same with the spray and wipes. If you're spraying the stuff around, it gets into the air and you've got all these tiny little particles. So all your cleaning products, change to eco-friendly. Change to EcoStore, of course, I'd say.
Yes.
You have to.
Because
I can guarantee that we're looking not after the environment, but we're also looking after your health, which we are one of the only brands in the world doing that. That's where we lead the world.
Yes.
Then you've got all your things like your face creams, hair shampoos. Again, with the hair, you've got the quite large pores where the hair follicle goes into your skull. And again, it's another way that chemicals can enter your system. The other thing is we're looking at if you want to grow vegetables at home, it's not as hard as you think, and do it organically. Much more fun. You don't need to be out there spraying pesticides and fungicides around, polluting yourself. And also, so those are the main three things, is basically cleaning your house, cleaning your body, and growing food that we look at EcoStore.
Very good. Basic, but a lot of people don't embrace it, do they?
It's amazing, even a lot of organic farmers actually haven't clicked on to what they're doing in their own houses. They haven't actually made the jump. It always surprises me.
Yes, I know, and I think, of course...
And probably yourself, you're probably using some of those nasties in your home, I bet, even.
I do.
But yeah, I bet you do.
Yes.
Because I'm not surprised. I'm not putting anything on you. It's just people just haven't thought it through.
Yes.
And the thing which stops a lot of people is the organic food actually has been our enemy in some ways because of the small production at the moment and the beginning. Organic food at the moment is more expensive than normal food. Okay.
Regrettable.
It is. But there's no way to stop that right now. Once you can get up to a certain amount and you can get bigger systems happening, that can change. But people see our products on the shelf, they look more expensive, and they think, oh, just the same as organics, I'd like to be able to use that stuff, it's too expensive. It's actually not. Because what we've done is we haven't played the game that the big multinationals have played. And what they do with the cleaning products is they make them full of what we call fillers, which don't do anything. So you get a box of laundry powder, up to 60 to 70% of that is just does nothing but gives you a nice big box to take home. They're actually filling it full of clay particles, so you're actually taking home dirt to wash your, wash your clothes on. And people say, oh, here I am, I'm getting this huge big box for sort of, you know, $5.99. I've got a bargain here. And they look at our little one next to it at $7.99. They say, oh, well, I'd like to use that stuff. It's too expensive. The difference is that our one is super concentrated. If you ever see the scoop we use, we're actually up to a third as much you use. So we've got a tiny box, lots and lots of washes. And if you look at the cost per wash of our eco products, they're actually cheaper than the chemical ones. But that's very hard to get across when you look at it on the shelf because it just looks small and expensive. And people say, oh, it's too much for us. But in reality, because of packaging, because of waste, we refuse to play the game of putting lots of fillers in and playing that game. So we're just giving the pure cleaning power. You only use a tiny amount. And over the years, we've done surveys of our customers, and the largest group of customers using our products have been in households of $30,000 and less. So these are not rich households, but they've actually worked out, as they use our products, they use the right amount, they're actually saving money than buying the chemical ones.
I'm really glad to hear that. Small packaging, small is beautiful, so we need to run with that. I think it's Shoemaker's statement. So, Mel, can we move over? This is wonderful. New Zealand as a potential haven for green sustainability as a country. How do you see New Zealand going forward?
Well, I actually go around trying to talk to business groups as much as possible and then spreading the message to the potential New Zealand actually has. And what really opened my eyes is that for a number of years I've been going to this huge trade fair called the Natural Products Expo, and it's held in Anaheim, which is across the road from Disneyland, in this convention hall, which is so huge. Everything's America, it's so huge. Like, you could actually fit most of Queen Street inside this convention hall. Like, hundreds of thousands of people there. Huge, huge, huge thing. And I don't know if you've ever been to America, but you go to America and you find that you say, oh, where are you from? I'm from New Zealand. And you just sort of get this blank look. Americans actually haven't got really much of a global outlook at all. They really don't know New Zealand. This was even with Lord of the Rings coming out and things. They still haven't really, even Australia is kind of vague to them. We think that the world knows about New Zealand and it's clean green, but most Americans haven't got much of a clue about the international, what's happening. So I go to this this place where there's Americans from all over America come here to buy natural products. You go in there and you talk to the people there. Everyone there knows about New Zealand. This is the one place in America you can go where New Zealand not only is known, that's loved and it's respected. Because if you think about it, there's people in this place, are the people running the little organic and green stores right throughout America. They're the ones who actually took notice of the Rainbow Warrior when it went down. They're the ones that took notice when New Zealand had its new anti-nuclear stand. In America, and so here we have this amazing niche in America, which New Zealand has just set up for so beautifully. And New Zealand is going to be a niche. We can't supply the world. We're small, we're tiny. You know, we've got less than 1% of the population, or less than half of 1% of the population. We can't, you know, we're a small player, so we have to be niche. So what I'm saying to business is the obvious thing for New Zealand is to become cement that New Zealand is where things natural, where things pure, where there's technology and research and development about organics, about sustainability, belongs in New Zealand. And the example I get is that using completely different products. In New Zealand, we make some beautiful bubbly wines. And if you make a very good one in the local supermarket, you might be able to sell it for $12 to $15. If that wine of that same quality came from this little part of France called Champagne, that same quality would be worth $50 to $100 because of the added value from where it comes from. And this is the potential New Zealand has, that people say, crikey, this is made in New Zealand. You know, this is where pure, this is where, you know, this is the planet. And suddenly, everything that comes from New Zealand has that same, that we can actually be the premium brand. We can actually really wrap up our wealth for us and our future generations because it comes from New Zealand. And we're missing a lot of this, you know. Like, so the thing is if we let genetic engineering to New Zealand, what a crazy, stupid thing for us today. Why are we even looking slightly at ruining our reputation, you know? Just things like that, everything we should be doing. Because unfortunately, New Zealand is not clean and green. It is the opposite. The clean and green countries in the world are places like Germany. And do you know why? In New Zealand, we have been blessed by nature, and nature has given us our clean and green, not what we do, because every day we have the purest wind and the purest rain on the planet coming from Antarctica up through the Tasman, and it blows and washes away all our naughtiness. And we've got hardly any people. And because of that, New Zealand has still got quite a good environment. It's not what we do. New Zealanders, if you look statistically, are bad polluters. And people are starting to understand this as it becomes more global, more travellers come through and see what's really happening. So we're in danger of losing our green status. Well, if you go to Germany, they've got no sea to speak of. They're surrounded by other countries. They've got 100 million people crowded in there. 20 years ago, their rivers started foaming. If water fell,
dropped in from a distance, from your height.
Height, mm-hmm. It'll foam. Mm-hmm. It's because there's so many people there, so much happening of just household chemicals and factories, that they were getting in big trouble. And so they had to think, oh my God, what are we going to do? Because it was a crisis. And so now a lot of the eco-technology we're using is actually coming out of Germany. That we're getting ideas from them to use in our business here in New Zealand because they had to. Whereas in New Zealand, because we've had it so easy, we're quite slack. And that is our danger. The danger in New Zealand is that we'll keep on being slack. In fact, the highest increase in use of cars in the world in a developed country over the last 15, 20 years has been New Zealand. We've actually gone the opposite way in eco indicators of where we're meant to be going. So what I'm saying is, hey, we're in danger of losing the one thing that we can actually give New Zealand wealth for the future if we don't look at what we're doing. So we've got to come back to looking at green technology, looking at research and development, how we can be the greenest, public awareness of what we're really doing. We've got to not just live on what God's given us, which is this land with not many people, being clean by nature. We've got that. We've got to put the human resource in there as well.
Yes, Mill, New Zealand's a treasure, and we definitely have to be aware of what we are putting across the land. And What do you think our true cost of our ecological footprint is? How do we stand?
Well, I suppose since we've just had the elections, we could actually talk about politics here. I mean, one of the policies which the Greens are putting forward at the moment, which I think actually has a lot of business sense, is what they call eco-taxes. And what happens then is that if behaviour in society is destructive towards the planet and sustainability, that behaviour should get higher taxation. And then if you're putting higher taxation into that behaviour, then you take it away from personal tax. So you're not increasing taxes, you're putting taxes on polluters and you're giving everyday people money back in their pocket. And so what's an example of this? Well, at the moment, if, say, like a big company has a really bad factory discharge or is polluting the local environment, at the moment, and they're just going to, as a community, we actually pay for that. Often they don't have to pay for it at all. You know, they can discharge into the local river at a certain level because it just hits the regulations, you know. It's not bad enough, it's so bad that they get a fine, but it's still as bad for the local river. Who pays for that? We as a community pay for it. We pay for it in the local river being degraded and the fishing stocks going down. Whereas if they had to pay a higher tax because they were doing that, then they'd have a financial incentive to change the way. Because at the moment, the market works very well. The free market actually works very well. If something is expensive to do, business will find another way of doing it. So if you made the bad, unsustainable practices more expensive, then businesses will change from that because it's in their interest to change for it. Where at the moment, they can get away with it. Here's another example. I was at a conference with NIWA, which is the they look at oceanography as well as climate. And they were saying that in the Manukau Harbour, they had recently come across, done some studies of seagrass. Okay, well, you say, what's seagrass? Well, you can kind of imagine it's underwater and it sort of looks a bit like grass. And they had a look inside the seagrass and they said, well, with the seagrass over the last 30 or so years, they've lost about 95% of the seagrass that used to be in the Manukau. It's just gone. And it's gone for a number of reasons I'll come to. And they said, well, what's actually the impact of that? They've never looked. So they looked into the last 5%, and what was in there? Tiny little snapper, kahawai, lobster. Because when fish lay their eggs, they go out as plankton, tiny little eggs. And in the stage, one of the stages is they need a safe place to go. And so they're going into the seagrass to protect themselves from predators. And they're growing up to the next size. So we blame overfishing for losing all our fish. But, hey, suddenly 95% of the nursery where they were going to survive has been taken away. And so it's not just overfishing. We've actually taken away how the fish can grow. And why is the seagrass destroyed? A little bit to do with chemical pollution, you know, so therefore there should be taxes on my multinational competitors' cleaners, you know. But mainly it's not that. It's a little bit that, but mainly what it is that when developers are doing new subdivisions, they do it in such a way that as soon as the rain comes, all the loose dirt gets washed away, ends up in the local harbours, and you get the siltation effect covering all these seagrass fields and killing them. So, and there's no tax on the developers not to do this. So why shouldn't they do it? So you see how an eco-tax would work? If it suddenly was more expensive for them to have those bad practices, they'd change. But at the moment, there's no reason for them not to be rough as guts, shall I say. And so they do it. And we as a community are losing because the true cost of that is suddenly our fish is a lot more expensive because there's only a fraction of what we potentially could have.
Yes, well, this is profound because we've had years and years of watching developers wipe off the trees or clear land for housing developments, and yet this still continues.
And, I mean, and why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't they? Because there's no reason why they shouldn't. And so therefore, if suddenly you collected, you know, so many tens of millions of dollars off the developers, it's not just money going to the government. You could actually give that money back to you and I in tax breaks. So it would be a win-win. So suddenly people on low incomes could have more money. And then suddenly the developers saying, hey, this is costing me a lot of money. Maybe I should change my practice. And there are ways that you can actually develop and subdivide the land without losing all that topsoil. There are ways of doing it. But there's no reason at the moment for those people to do it. And they're businessmen. They want to make money. They're just going to do it. It's just human nature. They're not bad people.
Right. Well, the Greens can't get enough traction. So who do we communicate with? Who in the political process, be it at local government?
Well, I think the key thing we've got to do is we've got to stop looking at the Greens to solve our problems. The people that you and I need to go and talk to are actually every party. And in particularly, I'd be actually targeting National and ACT, saying to them, well, hey, how come every time any sort of green initiative, your gut reaction is just to rubbish it and ridicule it, when it's your planet too, it's your grandchildren are coming into it, you know, your grandchildren could be living in somewhere like New Orleans in the future. I mean, don't have your automatic reaction as just to ridicule and rubbish. Let's get some really green platforms coming through from all sides of the spectrum, because green is not a left or right issue. It's an issue for all of us. It doesn't have to be socialist or capitalist at all. It's about looking after our planet, about living in the future.
Right. Well, when you make a move towards these National Party people, say, for instance, is this again, do we do this through personal contact, a group of you going? Does a submission, a written submission help, Mel?
I mean, New Zealand's great thing about New Zealand is it's still a small enough country that it's kind of like a village, you know. Like, if you talk to anyone in New Zealand, I bet you'll find out you'll know someone in common somewhere. You know, anyone you'd known after a while, the threads go everywhere. And I think we've got this amazing ability in New Zealand to actually just talk what you believe. You don't have to get to groups. You don't have to do submissions. Just do it yourself. I think those sort of things actually slow us down. Oh, that's a bit hard. Where am I going to find this group? When am I going to find the time? Just ring them up. Ring up your local MP. Just do it. I mean, that's a saying from a big multinational, Nike, I know, but it's true. Just do it.
Very good. Well, that's what we can say to listeners. It's a chance to mobilise, get out, and take advantage of the fact that new people are coming into Parliament now. We need to sort of not necessarily indoctrinate them, but we have to get to them. Mel, I agree on that. Now, tell me, with children, with these baby clothes, we know that when a child is born, they're absorbing everything. And, of course, mother's milk is one of the key ingredients, so we know now that more and more pollutants are coming through the milk as well. How do you see the education of mums to make sure that their children take good things? Is that,
I think actually the good thing for us is actually probably our best customers are actually new mums. Anyhow, I mean, I'd give them a lot of credit for that's one time of a life when particularly a woman, but even the husband and father actually reassesses their lives. You find that, particularly these days, a lot of people are partying hard right through their 20s into their 30s, leaving fairly active and hedonistic lives, and fair enough, having a good time, party. Suddenly their first baby comes along. Big change in their life. Huge change. The things that they're willing to do to their own bodies, they will not look at doing to their new baby. So it's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity. And I think when you look at people using EcoStore products, that's when we get a lot of our new converts, because that's the one time where people will start thinking about it. And so really it's up to all of us who can to get out there and talk to the Plunket, talk to the professionals, midwives. We do quite a lot of work that ourselves, just trying to get the message out there, because it is a wonderful opportunity for people to change their lives around. And that's one of the reasons we actually brought out a baby range of products to complement our household cleaning products, is to just to emphasise, hey, this is a change in life. You've partied hard now for 20 years now. Now it's time to relook at your life, and it's a great time to do it, yeah. Yeah, the other thing I was going to talk about, and I guess which really interests me, because it's the way that I came into this whole field, is actually just also looking at whether you can actually grow some of your food yourself. Because I think it's we're still lucky enough in New Zealand to have a section, which most people overseas don't. And most people overseas in our Western countries actually living in apartments. And most of us can actually grow a little bit. I'm not saying self-sustaining here, but I'm saying nearly everyone in New Zealand could have a few plants of silver beet, definitely all the herbs used in the kitchen, and other things which you can bring into you, because there's nothing like a vegetable cut straight out of your garden, put into a salad, you're eating it like minutes after it's been alive, or a corn cob that you snap off, like corn for example, within 10 minutes it's actually changed, the structure of the corn has changed from alive to dead. So if you can get that, if you can cut that corn, throw it straight into a pot and eat it, you've got a completely different animal that you can get anywhere else. So fantastic for people to do is, and there has been right around the world, people are taking up gardening more and more. And I'd kind of like to finish off our talk, jumping subjects from the grand into the small, about tips that I have come across in my own, because organic gardening is where I started the path to where I am today. And what it was, I'd done my OE in my early 20s, and I'd sort of seen the world, and it had been a great education to me. I'd lived in the richest parts of America, Orange County, just like on TV, and I'd seen what it was like to live the American dream. I'd been to third world countries. It had been a fantastic eye-opener to me. I'd been away from New Zealand 4 years, including earning money in Australia before I went. And I came back, and I felt I really wanted to get grounded. I was living with my mum, and I decided, wouldn't it be great to do a little garden in mum's backyard. And whether it was serendipity or whatever, the book I picked out of the library to teach me was a book on organic gardening, and I've never looked back since. And so that was in 1981 that I dug my first organic garden. And there's no reason today that anything you do in the garden can't be done organically. And then the second thing that has happened when we set up our village is we fell in with the idea of permaculture. And I don't know how many people have ever heard of permaculture, but that is a big layer on top of organics. And that's all about when you're doing something in nature, gardening or even your housing, wherever possible, you try and copy the same way nature would do it. Because even organic gardeners can actually end up creating quite unsustainable systems where they have to work so hard. You see a lot of these people go back to the land and they end up setting systems where they have to work so, so hard that they never make any money, their marriages break up, because it's not a sustainable system, because they're working so hard to get the organics to happen. And whereas nature seems to kind of grow stuff without any human input at all. How does it do it? So as much as possible, the difference between organics and permaculture is, in permaculture, wherever possible, you're setting up systems which copy nature. And so there's a few little principles I'd like to talk about with permaculture, which anyone can use, whether you're on a block out in the countryside or even in your own backyard here in the city. And the first one, I said, is copy nature. And I'd like to give examples of some of these things because it makes it more real. Now, this one, I admit, you probably wouldn't be able to do in a small city section, but it's a good example of what I wanted to do. And I wanted to provide my family with an egg. And you think, okay, well, how is the petrochemical way of providing an egg? And what happens? And so if you look at the egg you're getting out of a supermarket, basically you look at, okay, the chickens need to have food. Where does that come from? Believe it or not, it doesn't even come from New Zealand. Most of it's coming from these huge, huge, big farming plantations in Australia. So it's out in Australia on marginal land, which is actually becoming degraded all the time. Lots of chemicals, lots of irrigation, done with big, big tractors, petrochemical. These grains, we're talking about grain here, of course, put onto these super lorries, trucked thousands of miles to a port, put on big boats, sent across to New Zealand, all the energy there, put on trucks again, sent to these big factory warehouse farms on the outskirts of the big city, which if we're talking about the chicken battery operations. Okay, so therefore that's how the food has got for the chickens, right? And then you have the chickens themselves. As you know, I don't want to go too much into the horrible conditions, the cages, the chopped off beaks, the short lifespans. Also, the chickens, of course, are kept permanently on antibiotics, so they don't have to worry too much about cleanliness because they won't have disease problems. And we know now that this is really given human health a great knockback, because whereas antibiotics should have been lasting us 40 to 50 years before they became outmoded, now it's really quickly because they're being used permanently on animals all the time, and so the bugs are getting adapted to them much faster than they should have. So we're actually affecting our own health this way, getting rid of our cures. And then these eggs are put into more trucks sent to a supermarket where you buy yourself an egg. Okay, so that's the traditional egg a New Zealand family is going to eat today, is that egg. And as you can see, the energy inputs...
Phenomenal.
Okay. So I thought, okay, well, how does a permaculture egg come about? So therefore you have to think, well, where's a chicken from? Believe it or not, a chicken is a forest bird. And so my challenge was to set up a sustainable chicken forest close to my house. This is up in Mamaki Maiko Village, so right next, it has to be close to the house because you're going to be visiting it. You don't want it too far away. So what I did is I netted out this area, not that huge, and in this area I planted different types of fruit-bearing and berry trees at different times of years that drop fruit and berry into this area. On the netting around the outside, I actually grew vines, and on those vines, a lot of them like passion fruit type vines, where those fruits again would drop and the chickens would peck them open and eat out of them. Through on the ground, I grew lots of herbs, very strong herbs like comfrey, tough things, and the chickens would be eating those as well. I built a little house with a tin roof, and off the roof I collected the water, and the water went into the house had a concrete basin with a little pool in it, and so the rain would actually keep this little pool full of water, so therefore the system was self-watering. And then at the front I had this big bin, a huge compost area, and in there once a day I'd come with all my food scraps. Once a week or so I'd come with all the weedings from the garden, and I'd throw into this area, which you call a deep litter, and the chickens would go through this, scratching through it, eating out the food scraps, also eating out all the weed seeds, and they made me basically, and then pooping in it, they basically made me a compost. And so suddenly, what I'd do is once a day I'd come down with just a few handfuls of grain, not much at all, throw it in there, take out eggs, and that was a permaculture egg. The difference, as you can see, between the two systems, phenomenal. Phenomenal. Which one's more sustainable? Obviously, the permaculture one. Anyone could do that in the countryside. And even in a decent backyard in a city, you can actually have a smaller version of that, which is sort of like what's called a chicken tractor, where you make a little movable cage. You put it on the garden bed, which is resting, and the chickens, and you feed them on that bed. And over a matter of months, the chickens will go along and they'll scratch that soil, they'll eat all the weeds, they'll clean the soil up, they'll poop in it. And when you move it, you've got soil just ready to plant into. They've done the work for you. And you can actually use them to clean up the old garden beds and move it around. So even in the city, and I'm talking probably bantams here, but again, you're looking at how does nature work, you're copying that. Okay. Rule number one. Rule number two, choose your plants well. Basically what you're trying to do in permaculture is you're trying to grow useful weeds. Weeds pop up in soil where that sort of plant is needed. Because what happens is, even around a city like Auckland, if you're in a different area of Auckland, you've got different soils and different conditions. So what you need to do is you need to choose a plant which suits your conditions, that'll be healthy there, and then suddenly if it wants to be there, it won't need pesticides, it won't need fungicides. Going back to the old silver beet plant.
Always. I've always grown silver beet.
You know, it belongs here in New Zealand. It works really well. It's a tough plant. You don't have to worry about it. Almost leave it. I mean, that's what makes... If you choose plants that want to be there, great. And the last thing is, to make it easy for yourself, is what we call zoning, and that is that if you're growing herbs for the kitchen, where should you grow them? On the kitchen window, or at least outside the kitchen door. And so suddenly you're in the kitchen, you're cooking, oh, I want some herbs, bang, they're right there. A lot of people make the trouble of having some awkward little spot, and you don't get around to using them. If you choose how many times a day you're going to do something in the garden, the more you do it, make it closer to your life. And those three principles really will make your life easy, and you can grow amazing food at home.